What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends, and I've got something for my partner. I'm Larry Rifkin, John Kropczyk, of course, always by my side. And John, I've got something for you. I want you to try these slacks on, but you've got to make a quick decision.
Okay.
Do you want the blue ones that I'm holding in my left hand or the gray ones I'm holding in my right hand? Come on, no hesitation.
All right, I'm the blue.
All right. You took a stand because you may need to take a side and take a stand, because some people are thinking that the old blue and gray, that we're actually going to have another civil war in America. Can you believe that?
That would be a shame. That would be horrible if that happened again. I mean, look at the first civil war, what had happened with families, and I don't know, I couldn't imagine that.
Well, one of the most devastating conflicts we've ever been involved in. I mean, arguably, World War I, World War II were equally devastating.
Right.
But to the psyche of America, and ultimately, though, it was needed when the politics broke down. We couldn't come to compromise. And John, there are people today, and let me just quote one. He's a State Department official, Keith Mines, and this was in Foreign Policy magazine. You can look it up. And here's his quote. It's like 1859. Everyone is mad about something, and everyone has a gun. And that's America today. So the question is, when does this teapot boil over, and what is the precipitant for it? Because, you know, we've talked about it on this show, the identity politics and everybody fighting within their families, people who don't talk to each other anymore. Politics has become a blood sport. I mean, it's changed a lot.
Social media feeding you what you want to hear. I mean, you're right. It's horrible. But I would hope that smarter minds would prevail.
But John, where are those smarter minds? I mean, you can only let problems fester so long. I mean, we haven't been able to begin to tackle the obligations we're leaving to our kids with debt or our immigration crisis. We haven't been able to figure these out, and they've been going on for 20, 30, 40 years. So when does it come to a point where politics, when it's done well, gets people together and we solve problems? Well, when you stop solving problems, what do you do?
Well, the problem I see is
another problem?
The lawmakers in our land aren't doing their job. I mean, they're not working for us. They're working for, you know, making money to get reelected. And you know, I would hope people would get pissed off enough at Congress to really make a change, start voting people out. But
Let's talk about making some new laws that takes some of the money, the influence of the 1% out of the process. Last night on the Democratic debate, I think it was Kirsten Gillibrand from New York, and she said, look, unless we figure this stuff out and have fair representation and not the gerrymandering and everything else, nothing else will change. You're not going to get new policy
that's
unless you fix
true.
The democracy. And I think Pete Buttigieg was saying the same thing. So how do we begin to fix the democracy before it all boils over, John?
We need to vote these people out that are going in poor and coming out rich.
But they are going to continue because we see what happens with incumbency. If you do kind of curry favor with those special interests and you build up a war chest, ultimately you can drown out a challenger.
Everybody. Yeah, I know.
It's tough. It's interesting.
Tough.
You and I on the radio program many times had a guest on by the name of Bruce Judson, and he wrote that incredible book, It Could Happen Here. And so I would have him on just to update us, because he thought at that time that when you saw America flailing away, going from a conservative to a liberal and back to a conservative and then a more liberal, and, you know, just in the span of 4 and 8 years, and nobody was getting it done satisfactorily, I said, what happens after that? And he said, ah, that's where it comes apart. Because when you've exhausted all options and you've had people telling you, like Donald Trump, that I am going to fix it all, or Barack Obama, hope and change. And the things that you were hoping, certain things get changed. I mean, you know, Barack Obama got more people health care and all, but it's still not the full answer. You hear Democrats today saying, scrap that and let's go to this. So the point is that at that point, that's often when things really
hit the road. Problem is we seem to be going further out to the fringes instead of coming back to the center. Where are the Kennedy Democrats? Where are the conservatives?
The Kennedy Democrats, yes. On behalf of this nation, they are here. Now, Niall Ferguson from Stanford, he said, if we had a Civil War clock, like we have the atomic doomsday clock, he said it's 2 minutes to Fort Sumter. You get the reference?
Oh, yes.
All right. Well, for the sake of argument, what are the chances of America's disunion turning into all-out civil war? You're going to join us for this podcast, and you're going to start thinking about a really important issue. Ian Morris is with us, another Stanford scholar, historian, archaeologist, fascinating man. Now, he might calm what we have just made some jittery nerves, but maybe not. You'll have to listen on America Trends. With us on the line is Ian Morris. He's a historian and archaeologist. He is currently Stanford University's Jean and Rebecca Willard Professor of Classics. And you wrote an opinion piece, Ian, that I really want to talk to you about. And it's titled, What Are the Chances That America's Disunion Turns into Civil War? And this has become quite a parlor game in America. People wondering, are we closer to... are we farther away from? You know, people can't quite figure it out. We know how polarized we are, but does that equate to the likelihood or the imminence of actual civil conflict?
Yeah, well, I wrote this piece because at the end of last year, a lot of people were getting very worried that with all the things going on, that there's a potential that America could break apart and turn into real civil war. And Newsweek magazine did a poll, and something like one-third of all Americans thought that a civil war could break out within the next 5 years, and 1 in 10 Americans thought it was very likely to happen, which is a pretty astonishing idea.
Yes, I'd say so. However, I mean, what are the elements that are in play here? I know you talk about something that many of us don't even understand, formal and relational analogies, because if we're going back to 1859 and then into the 1910s decade, there are certain elements and certain fractures that look pretty similar, but does that really even tell us what the prospects for a civil war might be?
Yeah, now the thing about the formal and relational analogies, this is something philosophers like to talk about a lot. When you've got some problem you're trying to understand, and to make sense of it, you look at another problem about which you've got more information that looks kind of similar to the thing you're really interested in. And so you'll say, well, look, this is the same between the two cases, that's the same between the two cases. So maybe in the areas where we just don't know the answers in the thing we're interested in, maybe if we look at what happens in the better documented case, you know, we can just kind of transfer the answers across from one case to another.
Yes.
So people would look at the, you know, what's going on in the U.S. in the 1850s, say, oh, this is similar to now, that's similar to now, so we must be headed toward another civil war. But the problem with that kind of thinking is, of course, there's all these differences as well, and it's hard to factor those in. So the relational analogies, that's more a matter of saying, well, let's look at lots and lots of cases where there were civil wars and where there weren't civil wars. Find out what are the general patterns. What kind of things do you absolutely have to have for a civil war to happen? And I think when you look at it that way, well, everything starts to look a little bit different.
Well, you talk about polarization, sectionalism, financial problems, and political violence produced the Civil War in the 1850s. And, of course, well, there was that thing called slavery and two very different economic systems that were at play. And, of course, when we think about sectionalism in America today, a lot of the people on the blue states and the red states, they're a little bit commingled in the sense that you've got blue on the coasts, and you've got a lot of red in the middle, but it's not quite South versus North.
Yeah, and this is, of course, the minute you start getting into these questions, everything starts to look a little bit more complicated. And so you could look at the 1850s case and the 2010s case and say, okay, slavery, clearly we don't have slavery in the 2010s. But some people would push back and say, well, we don't have legalized formal slavery. But a lot of the things surrounding race relations in contemporary America, these have a lot in common with what was going on in the 19th century. And you know, obviously, some of the unrest that's been going on recently, you know, could be forgiven for thinking that kind of thing. And the same with the sectionalism and the splitting of the country, that you know, on the one hand, you can say, yeah, you look, you know, even at the most, say, you know, die-hard Republican states, there's still 20-30% of the electorate might be voting Democratic in the elections, and the other way around, of course, with die-hard Democrat states. And that probably isn't the case most of the time before the Civil War of the 1860s. And yet even then, of course, there is a mixture of people who are for and against the Union all over the country. So you know, all of these cases, the minute you start trying to use one historical case to explain another, the whole thing starts to get a little bit more complicated. But I think that's when you start to see, well, maybe what are the really decisive things here?
Well, Steve Bannon, who was President Trump's former strategist, as we all recall, said, and I'm going to quote him, 2019 is going to be the most vitriolic year in American politics since the Civil War. And he went on, I include Vietnam in that. If he's right, what does that look like? And that was a turbulent period. When we go back to the 1960s, you had Vietnam and you had all this black power and the unrest at a time of a great change with civil rights. So you had a real cauldron in the 1960s. Can we look at that and say it didn't spill over then, so why would it spill over now?
Yeah, that's a really good way to go about thinking about these sorts of problems, is to say, well, you know, as well as just looking at cases like the end of the 1850s that do lead to civil war, let's look at cases where you've got a lot of the same problems on the ground, and yet they don't end in civil war. And the late 1960s, of course, classic of this kind of thing. Students shot dead at Kent State, and you know, people burning down cities, and terrible things going on. I mean, I think on this, for once, I think I do agree with Steve Bannon that 2019 is likely to be a very, very vitriolic, problematic kind of year. But will it actually take us beyond where we were in 1968, 1970, into a real situation of civil war? And I got to say, I think that the most important factors to tip a country into civil war just aren't present in our case.
Well, we've got a deadlocked Congress. We've got a politicized court system that's really being stacked and packed, and he's doing it by virtue of some of the changes made by the Senate. And you've got a president who breaks every previous norm and actually threatens at times that he might have certain bullies on his side and certain arms and organs of the government that if he were to lose an election might protest in very ugly ways. So why is that not an elixir?
Yeah, well, that's a pretty, terrifying list of things, of course, when you start going down it. And I think the crucial thing here is what you were saying at the end there about, you know, President Trump has made these, I mean, not exactly statements, but these hints that if the worst came to the worst, he could call on friends in the police and the army who will make sure that he gets his way on really important things like serving a second term in government. And that, I think that is where you get to the real heart of the matter. Because whenever you look at countries that have tipped into civil wars, the decisive thing has always been the army. I mean, you've got an army that the whole point of having an army is that it's got this advantage in delivering violence. And, you know, if you decide that you don't want to pay your taxes or whatever, you know, you don't send your money in, you get this series of increasingly rude letters from the IRS, and eventually the police or the army are going to show up at your door armed with guns. And you can refuse to deal with them, but eventually you get to the point where the state has got more violence than you as a private citizen can possibly muster. And then you can fight them, in which case you lose, or you could just give up and go along with them. And so long as a government has got an army that has this advantage in violence over any other organization in the society, and as long as the army will unquestionably follow the laws and the Constitution, then civil war, I mean, I can't find a single case where civil war has really been a possibility in a situation. As long as they've got an army that is strong enough that it can face down any other group of people, any institution within the country, and as long as the army is willing to follow the laws and the constitution and do what the rules say it should do. I think the problems come in when you either haven't got an army in the position able to do that, or the army stops following the rules. And so I think the big question for the country, I mean, if it ever got to the point where a civil war begins to seem like a possibility, is what would the army do? Would it follow its tradition of remaining loyal above all else to the Constitution? Or would it be willing to obey the orders of a president, even if they were not constitutional?
When you looked at Jim Mattis, the previous defense secretary, who basically found himself at odds with the president, and you talk about a soldier and somebody who wanted to uphold the Constitution, even though he had the appellation Mad Dog, he was very much institutional in the way that he looked at the responsibility of somebody wearing the U.S. uniform. So in a sense, he left. He didn't go against the president, but he certainly made his views known that they were incompatible in their understanding and interpretation of constitutional norms. So, I mean, are we already seeing something of a rupture in the executive branch and the Defense Department?
Yes, I think you're right. I mean, that case and several others where the president seems to be much more willing than any recent predecessor to push established institutions and tell them to do things that most of the people serving in them seem to think are not part of their mission and just not right for them to do. And so, I mean, the big question would be, what would the army do if the president ordered them to do something like, say, ignore the results of an election? And, I mean, everything that I've seen of the U.S. Army suggests to me that we can expect it to remain absolutely true to its traditions of following legitimate and legal orders, but refusing to follow ones that are not legitimate or legal.
But then what happens? I mean, that's the question I have, because in the United States, we have certainly made a separation of church and state, but we've also made a separation of where the army can come in as it relates to domestic issues or conflicts. So whether it's the National Guard under the control of a state, that's one thing for different emergencies. But the use of the army, even on the border now, as we're dealing with all kinds of homeland security issues, that's a real no-no, that they are not supposed to be doing much work that looks as if it's internally directed.
Yeah, well, it would be the mother of all constitutional crises, obviously, if the president orders the army to disregard the result of an election and to come and protect him in the White House. And I think, I mean, nobody can really say, we can guess, but nobody really knows what would happen under circumstances like that. And again, everything I've seen of the U.S. Army suggests that just very few people, whatever their personal political views, would be willing to back up a president who said something like that.
Let me go back, because we can debate forever what the military's response would be, but I don't think we know. I really don't, because we haven't been put in this circumstance. But take us back to the 1860s. We did have a standing army, the United States, but it was very small, relatively speaking.
Yes, it was. I mean, a tiny little army. And it was scattered around over, you know, over this enormous country that was ruled from Washington, D.C. I think it was like something like 16,000 men or something. And the vast bulk, like 90-some percent of the troops, were stationed west of the Mississippi. So, you know, they may as well have been on another planet, so far as people in Virginia and Washington, D.C. were concerned. So there's no possibility of Abraham Lincoln simply calling up the army, sending it in to put down the risings in South Carolina and so on. And this gives time for the Confederates. Of course, a lot of the army officers do defect to the Confederacy. It gives them time to build up an army. And, you know, right from the get-go, there's a rough military parity between the two sides. And that, it's not like that now.
Absolutely. Let me go back to the Economist magazine, their Democracy Index. And they took the U.S. from a full democracy to a flawed democracy in a poll in January 2017, citing the big drop in America's trust for our political institutions. As you look at it, is that an accurate assessment? And secondly, what impact does that have when trust begins to erode almost completely in all the institutions that are meant to protect us from that which we have seen in the world outside of our own democracy? When does that become a really defining characteristic of people willing to take to the ramparts?
Great line that Ernest Hemingway is supposed to have come up with when somebody asked him, what has it been like to go bankrupt? And he said, it had been gradual, then sudden. And I think something like this, a constitutional collapse of this kind, it would be a similar kind of thing, that it was unimaginable that you can find yourself on the verge of civil war unless there's been some kind of ongoing erosion of confidence in the basic functioning of the institution. But then if it goes, it goes suddenly. And, of course, this is exactly what happened in the U.S. In 1861. It's what happened in England in 1642. It's what happened in the Roman Republic when its civil wars began. You have a gradual decline of confidence in the ability of government to get things done. And then somebody does something which hadn't been expected before. They raise an army in their own name, or they kill one of their rivals on the floor of a Senate, or something like that. Something abrupt happens, and we tip over the edge. And I think this is why it's so difficult to predict where and when civil wars are going to break out. Because you can have this long-term erosion of confidence going on for decades, but then that special something doesn't quite happen. Like, say, in the Arab Spring, the thing that triggers it in Indonesia is a fruit vendor setting himself on fire. Who knew the guy was going to do that? Who knew everyone was going to react in the way that they did? And, if he hadn't set fire to himself that day, maybe none of what has happened since 2011 would actually have happened.
Well, look at the brave person in Tiananmen Square. If the power wasn't so much undistributed, it was all in the hands of the government, what would have happened there? I do want to ask you, Bruce Judson, and I have interviewed him. He was a Yale adjunct for a long period of time. He wrote a book called It Could Happen Here. And he says that civil wars are possible when you've tried everything else, when you've tried reformers to come in. For example, you had Barack Obama, hope and change, and then all of a sudden we took a wild swing to Donald Trump, so people on the other side saying, hey, this is my shot to get it right. They both don't get it right. The body politic bounces from one extreme to the next, and yet we don't see the problems in America being fixed to anyone's satisfaction. And he said that's when things really come apart.
Yeah, I think that clearly is a good way to think about some of the things that are going on, that people are just trying different solutions and getting increasingly worried about the situation. And the more worried you get, perhaps the more inclined you are to try something a bit radical that you never would have done a few years earlier. But that said, there are certain limits on what's possible. And so nobody can just suddenly announce, well, I'm just going to make the economy somehow magically better. It doesn't work that way. There are limits on what you can do. And I think with turning to violence, the limit is always going to be the response of the state's own armed forces. If people rise up in the streets in support, say, of Donald Trump, if he loses the election, then refuses to step down, in a way, it's not that different from when people rose up in the streets in 1968 after Martin Luther King gets assassinated. And of course, what happens there is the National Guard is called out, the uprisings are put down. And so I think the question has to be, is that what would happen in 2019, 2020, if something similar were to happen? Would the armed forces stay loyal to their traditions, to the Constitution, and to legality generally? Or are they actually ready to flip and just kind of go berserk on us?
And have a military leadership in America. Boy, we haven't seen that. Boaz Hemery, he's a professor at UPenn. He said that violence is most likely to occur when political leaders use dehumanizing language to describe their opponents. Now, this is going on in America today to a fairly well. We don't look at our political opponents as opponents. They are now enemies, each of us, on whatever side. And so when we're now looking at each other not as just friendly rivals or a team of rivals all caring about America, but now enemies, that would seem to conjure up possibilities and notions almost unthinkable in the past.
Yeah, I think this, again, this is one of the things that can chip away at the legitimacy of our institutions and push us toward being willing to think about taking really, really extreme steps. Because there have been periods in the past where people have used language way, way worse than what we're seeing now. And, several points in the 19th century in the US, the newspapers, we complain now about mainstream media and Fox Cable News and these sorts of things. But at several points in the US, the newspapers really were paid up affiliates of political parties or even individuals. And you bought a newspaper knowing that it's only ever going to say good things about one guy and bad things about another. And they would say the most kind of staggering things about, abusive, insulting things about each other. And, similar sort of things, say, in the British democratic system at some points as well. And so I think we haven't gone as far with the abuse as it's possible to go. But again, it doesn't necessarily mean that it translates into an actual violent outcome. It's certainly a really bad thing, I think, for a democracy to have people willing to believe that if you voted for Hillary Clinton, then you condone murder and you are just a wicked person who wants to see America sold out to the United Nations and the black helicopters and so on. I mean, obviously that's not good. But it's still, it's very different from taking guns and moving troops around the country and actually killing people.
However, in 1859, and I don't know whose quote this is, everyone was mad about something and everybody had a gun. Well, how different is that from where we are today?
Yeah, it's really, really similar. But again, I think this is the sort of place where saying, okay, we can identify these similarities, but there's some important differences as well. I think that this is the point where this becomes so crucial. And as I see it from comparing all these different cases, the crucial variable always is the dependability of the army. And like saying with the Arab Spring example we talked about a moment ago, in some countries like Tunisia, the army just, or Libya, the army just kind of fades away when the uprising starts. The army isn't available to the president to go out and shoot all the protesters. But in Egypt, the army didn't do that. The army kind of pushed Mubarak out sort of to let the truck run over him, but they weren't about to let people just do whatever they wanted, because Egypt, it ended up with a military rule.
But you really have put a wild card on the table. What would our military do, and what is a legitimate command, and whose commands would they follow at some point, Nancy Pelosi or Donald Trump? By the way, I do want to ask you, it's really interesting because you come from a system, a multi-party party parliamentary system in the UK, and of course we have a very different system of government here, and when centrism, which is required in a two-party large tent system, begins to erode, and people say, we can't find any more centrists. They're not either being elected because of the way that the primary system is built or gerrymandering. They're gone. So we only have people on the extremes. Is that another precursor to unrest?
Yeah, I think that's right again. It's another one of these things that chips away at this assumption that we're all in this together and we have to work together to find solutions. We have to make compromises. And the British system is different in many, many ways from the American, but we're seeing some similar kinds of trends going on there. Although I guess I would say in the British case, one of the things that's gone even further than in the US has been the sense that the older established political parties are just no longer very coherent. And so in the this heated debate over leaving the European Union, you get people who want to stay in both the Conservative and the Labour parties, and you get people who are really rabid about leaving in both these parties. So it's not just that the centre itself fails to hold, it's that the actual parties are kind of disintegrating too.
Well, we have some of that in America, according to other scholars.
Yes,
well, I did find that quote. It was Keith Mines who told Foreign Policy, it is like 1859. Everyone is mad about something and everyone has a gun. And he pointed to the fact that he thinks a second American Civil War breaking out, the possibility within the next 10 to 15 years, he puts it at 60%. Your thoughts?
I think I would put it at less than 6%, much, much lower. And again, like we've been saying, neither of us knows exactly what the military would do in a situation like the kind of thing Donald Trump has been hinting at. I mean, the army officers I know, they tend to be fairly senior guys who are attached to my university in various kinds of capacities. And with them, I just find it impossible to imagine any of them, considering for a moment doing something that is clearly against the Constitution. But one of the things I think we do learn from all these other civil wars is it tends not to be the four-star generals who are actually important here. It's the junior officers, the young, the majors and the young colonels who, often have a lot more in common with the angry people in the population at large. And they're maybe willing to take a bit more of a chance on things. And those are perhaps the people we need to be thinking about most.
Very interesting wild card that you've thrown into a conversation that's growing in terms of tone and loudness at this point. And that is, what are the chances that America's disunion turns into civil war? Ian Morris from Stanford University, thank you so much for joining us today on America Trends.
Well, thanks for having me on the show. It's been a lot of fun.
Hey, Larry, I got some exciting news.
Well, let's hear it, John.
We are now part of the MHNR network.
Really? Where can you find the MHNR Network?
We can find us at MHNRnetwork.com.
Let's go there right now.
All right.